Hello and welcome to another exciting and jam-packed episode of Modern Day Philosophers. I'm your host, I'm Danny Lobel. You are whoever you are, or so you say you are, aren't you? Isn't that what you said? Anyway, so last night of Hanukkah, everybody, so happy Hanukkah. And if you celebrate Christmas, that's coming up, Merry Christmas. Hope you're having a good holiday season, hope it's fun. I'm doing okay here in LA. This episode today is brought to you by Stand Up Records, the name you know, the name you trust. Here, take a listen to this quick word from our sponsor.
Warning. Last year, over 40,000 Americans died in car-related accidents. Not a pleasant thought, is it? In fact, as thoughts go, it's downright depressing. Well, that's where we can help cheer you up. We're StandUpRecords.com, and we offer the finest in CDs, DVDs, downloads, and merchandise from the best comedians on Earth. Artists like Marc Maron, Maria Bamford, Eddie Pepitone, and Doug Stanhope. Available at fine record stores, Amazon.com, and the iTunes Music Store. That's StandUpRecords.com. Come on, listen to us while you're driving. Live dangerously.
Go buy some records this season. Go pick up mine. Danny Lobel, some kind of comedian. And if you're feeling generous, I could always use the support for the show. Go to moderndayphilosophers.net and make a donation. Also, just check out the site. I've been updating it. Love to hear what you think. Want to know. Moderndayphilosophers.net. If you send a donation of $20 or more, I will personally thank you. I'll figure out something I can send you. But it is the end of the year, so our promotion with Tweaked Audio has come to an end. The good folks over at Tweaked Audio have been very good to us, sending out those free earbuds to everybody. And if you were supposed to get them and you didn't, please let me know. But in the meantime, you can still get Tweaked Audio earbuds. You just can't get them as a thank you anymore, but you can get them at one-third off. One-third off. Plus free shipping and a lifetime guaranteed. A guarantee of a lifetime full of fun. I don't think that's what it is, but go to tweakedaudio.com and put in my promo code MDP, short for Modern Day Philosophers, and you will get that deal. Now, today's episode is with the awesome Susie Essman, opposed to that other Susie Essman that nobody likes. But that's not this one. This is the great Susie Essman from Curb Your Enthusiasm, the name you know, the name you trust. I don't know. When I did this episode in New York, it was a rough day for me. I had that Last Comic Standing audition coming up, the original one I've told you about in New York. And in my crazy brain, I'm like, you know what? I gotta lose weight. I'm like, I gotta lose weight. That's when it hits me. I'm like, I better lose weight before this TV audition. I had 1 week. So I decided to go hard. I started running the boardwalk in Long Beach, but it was cold, and I'm also not used to running, and I also have asthma, and it triggered it. And, you know, my lungs got weak from the running, and I wound up with real bad asthma. It's the stupidest idea I could have possibly had, like, I'm going to do 1 week of exercise, and then I'll be in TV shape. But whatever, that was my thinking. So, went running on the boardwalk for 2.5 mornings. By the end of the, you know, it was supposed to be the third morning run of the boardwalk, I was wheezing so bad I had to go home and call it quits. And the next day I interviewed Susie Essman. And before the interview, I had a pretty bad asthma attack. And I was like, I'm not canceling this interview. I got to do it. I did, you know, it took a while to set up. Susie, by the way, has been awesome to me my whole career. I've gotten to open for her. When I had a magazine, she did an interview for a cover. When I was working on a TV show at AOL, she came in and did the show. I don't know. Anything I've ever asked her, she's always been there for me. And I wasn't about to cancel an interview with her. So I went there all wheezy, and I held it together real strong through the interview. I got to tell you, I had this asthma attack right before I went up there. And I was in bad shape. But sometimes when you will your body to, like, you can keep yourself strong just as long as you need to be. But as soon as you stop, everything comes crashing down. So right after this interview, I had like the worst asthma attack I've had in years. And I wound up 2 blocks away from Susie's place in the hospital, in the ER for the rest of the day and into the night on nebulizers and all kinds of shit. So that is dedication, folks. I the show must go on. I pulled through, I got the interview. And Susie was awesome, as she always is, and I can't wait for you to hear it. And I'll tell you some more stuff about what's going on with me after the show today. So stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, let's get right into it. Here it is, your holiday show. Me and Susie Essman at her apartment in New York City. Right after the intro song. Enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to Modern Day Philosophers.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Having failed to pay attention in school, Danny Lobel, now older and wiser, will attempt to learn basic philosophy 101. Our young hero will be joined by today's top comedians, philosophers all their own. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Danny Lobel.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Hello, test, test, test. How you doing?
Test, 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 test. I'm doing good.
All right, sound good. Thanks for having me at your place.
My pleasure.
I'm here with Susie Essman, who I've had the honor of opening for in the past, and one of the great honors of my career.
Oh, I hope not, Danny.
It's been that bad, Susie.
Are you really?
How are you? What's new?
Oh, what's new? I just moved. I've been renovating for 3.5 years between my house and my apartment. That's about it.
That's a full time. That's like a full time job renovating.
Yeah, exactly. You have to make a lot of decisions. Like now, it's like, what knobs do you want? What threshold do you like? Things you never even fucking thought of in your life, and all of a sudden, right. You have to make decisions. So, but my husband and I are still together after fully renovating. House built in 1922 and renovating this apartment, and we're still together and still civil.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
I remember my mom's friend when I was a kid renovated her house and it caused a divorce.
It can do that. It's extremely stressful on a relationship, but we still like each other.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kylie and I rented a house in LA, and I've been fixing it up little by little by just going to Lowe's.
Yeah.
And I think they know that I'm just a bum at this point because I'm there at all times of day with stupid questions.
They don't care.
Yeah.
They want your money.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They don't care.
No.
But it's fun, you know? I feel like I'm really doing something.
What kind of Jew are you?
What?
That's handy.
I'm.
Oh,
yeah.
You're not.
I am handy. I have to be, you know? My girlfriend's converting. She, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
She wouldn't stand for a guy who's not handy.
Wow. That's love.
Her dad's a contractor. I'm up against that.
So he can't do stuff for you?
Well, he's not in Los Angeles.
My husband was a contractor and is very handy, guyish. But I feel like to marry someone unhandy is a complete waste of time.
It's a complete...
It is. It's a complete... Unless it's like he serves some other purpose, like a doctor can write prescriptions, but that's easy. Now there's these urgent care places,
uh-huh.
So you could go there 24 hours a day and get prescriptions. So I can't think of anything else that's real. A mechanic, maybe, would be good.
What,
would come in handy.
What does he do now? You said
he's
was
in
a
real
contractor.
Estate. Yeah, he's amazingly handy. Amazingly handy. You know, our other house, he finished our basement. And I remember I was on the set and I told Larry David that Jimmy finished our basement. He couldn't even conceive of what I was. He was like, well, what do you mean? He hired a guy, right? It's like, no, he did it himself. I don't understand what you mean. He got a crew. I was like, no, he did it himself. He couldn't even conceive of the fact that my husband by himself finished the basement.
It was so beyond him.
It was beyond his conception.
It's true. You know, when I first started dating my girlfriend, she's like, what do you mean you can't do anything? I was like, oh, I better get. But I tried explaining I'm a Jew. We don't do anything.
Yeah, but there's a lot of TV shows you could watch now.
Yeah, I do. I watch
the
YouTube.
By the way,
yeah,
I watch HGTV. When you're renovating, you watch HGTV because you get ideas, and they're all full of shit. Because they'll come in, they'll say, I could renovate your basement, give you a full finished basement, a new bathroom, a new master suite with a master bathroom, and a brand new kitchen, top of the line appliances for $15,000, and we'll do it in 5 weeks. It's a lie.
Yeah, when you try to do it yourself, it comes
it's
out way, way more than that. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I find it funny how there's so many shows with people fixing up houses all the time. And it's just for everybody sitting in lousy houses watching it going, oh.
Well, but that's not true. People really care about their homes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's your biggest investment usually in your life is your house, if you buy a house. And people want to fix it up, and it's expensive, and they want to figure out how to do it and make it look fantastic and not have to spend a lot of money. There's right. no way to do it without spending money. That's my key to decorating. You don't have to spend a lot of money, but you have to spend money.
Yeah.
I'm a big flea market person.
Do you really? Do you go to a lot of flea markets?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you go yourself?
Yeah.
You don't have like an assistant that goes flea market shopping for you?
I don't have an assistant at all. This is my assistant.
Yeah?
This little shih tzu here. He's my assistant.
Why is that? So many of the people I interview have an assistant. Why?
Because I'm a control freak.
Uh-huh. Really?
No, I don't want an assistant. I don't want somebody up my ass all the time. I don't have enough to do. I'd rather do it myself. That's what you have kids for. I have kids.
Yeah?
Yeah, well, I didn't birth them. They're his kids.
Okay.
But I brought them up for the past 10 years.
How is that? Do you feel just as close with them, do you think, as if they were your own?
No, I think it's different. I think I feel differently close to them. I think that being a step-parent has different challenges and pluses and minuses, but I think I see parenting differently from people who have their children from infancy and bring them up. I see it much more objectively, and I think it's made me a better parent because I'm not, first of all, I don't have that narcissistic tie to their DNA,
yeah,
you know? And I think I see them very clearly, and I have no agenda with them whatsoever. So I'm able to be a very kind of pure parent to them.
You don't want to push them to be a certain way in your image or whatever.
No, not at all. And I don't need them to like me. You know, that's the kiss of death for parenting is when you need them to like me, like one. And then they end up liking mm-hmm. me. Like at different times, I'm sure they've all hated me, but whatever.
Have you ever wanted to have kids of your own?
No.
Never?
No, just dogs. Not give birth to dogs, just have dogs.
Do you ever think about why? Why you didn't want to?
Because when I was of childbearing years, which I no longer am, I there wasn't a man that I wanted to have kids with. And then I just was busy with my career and just didn't feel the need, really. I just didn't feel the... Maybe if I was married to somebody and you know, wanted to raise a family, but I just didn't feel the need. And then... Of course, you know, my grandmother used to say, you make plans and God laughs.
Yeah.
I end up marrying a guy with four kids and brought up four teenagers.
Yeah, yeah. So you wind up with the best of both worlds, kind of.
Yeah, but bringing up four teenagers was very challenging. They're like mentally ill people with car keys.
What do you think are the best parts of marriage?
Well, I really like my husband. He's my best friend. I really like him. I enjoy his company. We like to watch the same things on TV. That's the key to a good marriage. You have to watch the same, not everything, you know, but you have to basically like to watch the same things on TV because that's what you spend a lot of time doing.
Do you watch mostly home decorating shows? Or?
Well, he's not so into those, but he'll watch them with me every now and then. Just like every now and then, I'll watch the Golf Channel with him.
So what are the ones that you both agree on?
Well, a lot of sports. Mm-hmm. We both like sports. We both like these really, you know, boring documentaries on the History Channel. You know, he loves the Weather Channel. I could take it for a little while. He'll be into some more violent stuff that I can't watch, mm-hmm. And I'll be into some more decorating stuff that he can't watch. But basically, we can meet common ground. And we like, you know, like all those like, you know, like all those great masterpiece mysteries. You know, Endeavor and Sherlock and all those. We like mysteries.
Mysteries, yeah. And sports.
And sports and news.
They all have that same uncertainty to them. The mystery, yeah. The sports, and the news. You don't know how
I'll
it's
tell
gonna...
you what we don't watch.
What?
Comedy.
Never?
Never.
Why?
I've never watched... I mean, when I was growing up, I did. But as a professional, I just don't watch comedy on TV.
Is it because you don't like seeing other people working? Or
no, I like seeing other people working. I like, if you know, I like laughing. It's just... It just doesn't interest me, really. I'd rather watch drama.
That's interesting to me.
Yeah.
Never, huh?
I watch Curb.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You know, you're in the minority. Most people don't like to watch what they're in.
Well, I don't like to watch myself. I like to watch episodes I'm not in. The show makes me laugh. But I actually, well, that's not true. That's the only time I could watch myself is on Curb. Because I'm playing such an, you know, a broad character that it's uh-huh. not even me. And she does tickle me. But I can't watch myself, like if I'm doing a guest spot on Jimmy Fallon or if I'm myself mm-hmm. not playing, I can't watch it all.
Why is that?
Oh, God, I can't watch. I have no interest to see myself at all. I live with myself 24/7. I have to watch myself now?
It's always interesting to see people articulate why they don't like watching themselves.
Oh, I cringe. Yeah. But I can watch Susie Green because she's so over the top, and I find her so amusing.
She's not even you at a certain point.
No, she's not, me. I put on those outfits, and I just become her, and I'm tickled by her.
When you get into the character, are you thinking differently?
Yes.
You're thinking as her with a...
Yes, absolutely.
Do you have a whole backstory for her life in your head?
Not really. Not intensely, except that I've decided that Jeff and I were some distant relatives of Mo Green. And that's about as far as it goes.
Yeah, okay. How did you meet Jeff? Have you created
a... I don't know. I'm not that kind of actress.
Yeah.
No, I just become her. Either I connect to a character and just become them, or I don't connect to it. And then I have to... Then if I don't connect to it, then I got to figure out some whole mishigas about who she is and what her relationship... But if I connect to a character... And don't forget, I created Susie Green. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't like there was a part written. I made her up, basically.
Did you make her up before Curb and you had her ready to go?
No, she evolved. But Larry and I never had a conversation about who she was. We kind of had a dialogue of the unconscious, Larry and I, where he got what I was doing and wrote to it, and I got what he wanted me to do and just gave him more of it. And then our relationship, on-air relationship, evolved, who we were to each other, and it just all kind of evolved. We've never had a conversation about it, ever.
Never, ever. So what do you think about acting? Do you like acting?
I like acting. I enjoy it. Well, it depends on the part. You know, if it's a part that I can connect to, I really, really enjoy it a lot. And I only connect to parts that are not, well, there's always a piece of me, but that are different for me, because I don't want to just play me. It's interesting to me to become another character and to play out a other relationship. It's all fantasy. You're playing out relationships with other people. You know, you're married to someone else. You have different kids. It's all just make-believe and fantasy.
Yeah.
It's what I always did when I was a kid. So it's just another aspect of that. The only thing I really hate about drama is memorizing lines. I hate that. Comedy, I don't have such... I just did a guest star in Broad City, and I had no problem memorizing lines. When I do a dramatic role, I have a harder time. Somehow the comedic rhythm is more in my head and easier for me to get to.
Yeah, and it's built in.
Yeah.
You know, you develop it after so much time. It's like... It's right there,
I know
ready
my timing.
To plug into.
Yeah. The only thing I hate is when I get these scripts and they're not funny and they ask me to make them funny. It's like, it's not funny. What am I, a magician?
Does that happen a lot?
Yeah, it happens. Oh, give it to her. She'll make it funny. It doesn't work that way.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. But when Larry writes something, I know it's going to be funny. I don't even think about being funny. It's one of the reasons I love doing that show is I never, ever think about being funny. Because I have such confidence in what he wrote. Even though it's improvised, his outline and his creating the scenario, so that I just get to really act in that show, where I just get to be Susie Green and know what my intent is and go after it and never think about being funny.
That's nice. That's great. Very relaxing.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. It's so much fun, and it's so creatively interesting.
Yeah. Now, what about improvising on stage? Do you ever do any of that?
I started out doing improv, and I did it years and years ago, but I haven't done it in a long time. I think I'd be scared at this point.
Really?
Yeah.
Scared of what?
I don't know. Maybe it won't be funny.
I think everyone else would be scared. Oh, Susie's in this group.
No, you know what? I improvise in my act, but I always know where I'm going, and so I have my structure in the back of my head, so if something's not working, I know where to go to. Mm-hmm. If I was doing pure improv, the problem with me as a comedian, with a lot of comedians have this problem, is you get addicted to killing. Mm-hmm. You get addicted to laughs. So if something's not working well in improv, I wouldn't know how to save it necessarily. But I should probably, now that I'm thinking about this, challenge myself and do it.
Why not? Who cares? You ever think about that?
It never occurred to me, Danny. I'll go do it now.
There was a reason I came here.
Exactly.
Today. I get these fears too about different things. Like I mentioned to you, I have this audition coming up, and
right.
I've always kind of been terrified of putting myself out there on television, because what if I'm not ready yet, and what if I don't come off good, and everybody.
But everybody has that fear. I have that fear every time I step on stage. I have that fear. What if I'm not funny? My husband always said, when were you ever not funny? When did you ever die? I was like, this time. This is the time that I'm going to die.
That's exactly the conversation I have with Kylie.
Everybody has. Yeah. You're not alone in that. I had this conversation this morning with Joy Behar about the fear we have every time we get on stage and how ridiculous it is at this point because we've been on stage 10, 20,000 times. Who even knows?
Right.
And yet it's still there.
But if it wasn't there, you probably wouldn't want to do it.
You know, there are times when it's not there, when I'm very relaxed. And I've always kind of been suspicious thinking, superstitious actually, thinking that if I don't feel it, I'm not going to do well. It's not true. There have been times when I haven't felt it and I've done just as well. Mm-hmm. So it's a waste of time because it makes me crazy.
Is it less gratifying if you're not, if you don't have that fear?
No.
You don't miss it?
No. No, it just makes me mentally ill. And it makes me not want to get on stage.
So it's a complete waste, the fear. Because that's what I was going to tell you about this television thing. I think to myself, well, what if I die? You know?
And you die.
No. I mean, then it doesn't matter if I sucked on television or anything.
Oh, you mean you die, literally die?
If I literally die.
Oh, I thought you meant die on stage.
No, I'm much more morbid than that. I think, what if I, you know, I'm a heavy guy. I could drop dead any day. You never know. So why not risk it? You know, why not?
Yes, but even if you're not a heavy guy and could drop dead at any day, anybody could drop dead at any day.
Right.
At any minute, which is why you really should just do the things you want to do and not be afraid. I don't mean stupid shit.
Right.
You know, but yes, ready, not ready. You know what? Worst comes to worst. You're not ready, and you do it again next year. Or you do something different next year when you're more. But I would bet you're ready.
Thank you. That's nice of you.
Listen, I am deathly afraid and feel a deep sense of dread every time I have to get on stage. I do it anyway. I do it anyway. I wouldn't let that hold me back. I would let it hold me back from bungee jumping or something like that because I have no interest in that. And it doesn't give me the same thing, gratification. But yeah, you have fears and you just, yes, you're afraid and you just keep on moving forward.
Do you ever step back and think these days, why am I still driven to do this? Why am I punishing myself
money.
With this fear? Really? It's just about the money?
It's not just about money, but there's something that happens when you reach a certain point and they're actually paying you money to do this. I mean, I did it for no money, for free for so long. Uh-huh. And I really, now I make a living doing stand-up, and it's quite incredible that I make a living making people laugh. I mean, I never thought I was going to make a living making people laugh. It's it's insane.
Well, I'm glad you do. I mean,
me too.
Yeah.
And people always say, what would you do if you didn't do this? I don't have an answer to that question. I have no answer to that question whatsoever.
I don't think anybody does.
No.
It's a lousy question.
Yeah.
Because...
like, what's your favorite color?
Yeah.
How shallow am I that I only have one favorite color?
It's a stupid thing or a favorite...
There's a number of colors I enjoy.
Right. It's a dumb thing they make kids come up with.
Who's your favorite group? The only one group? It's ridiculous. Who's your favorite philosopher?
I want to laugh so badly, but I have this stupid asthma, and it's causing me...
All right, well, have a drink of water, Dan.
Yeah, thanks.
I was actually a philosophy major my first semester of college, but the reading was a little dry for me, so I switched.
What attracted you to becoming a philosophy major?
Well, it's interesting, you know, and it sounded more interesting than it actually... I mean, it was interesting. It was just... It was too heady for me. It was too heady.
Yeah, it's tough. That's why I do this show. I try to break it down.
Yeah.
But because it is all interesting. You know?
I'm afraid of who you're going to say now.
All right. Well, I'll tell you who you have. You have, and I probably...
Soren Kierkegaard.
Niccolo Machiavelli.
Oh, Machiavelli. Okay.
You know him?
Yeah. The Prince.
I know the name. I know...
The Prince.
Susie's best known for playing a tyrannical character on Curb Your Enthusiasm, so here's a philosopher who talked about tyranny.
Which I don't believe she's a tyrannical character, but that's another discussion.
You don't believe she's a tyrannical character?
No. Everything she does is justified. You know, Larry is constantly provoking her, as is Jeff. Jeff's cheating on her left and right. She finds a pair of girls' panties in his glove compartment. Larry steals her kid's doll's head, her kid's dog. He gets them kicked out of the country club. On and on and on. She's always provoked.
So she is a victim.
I don't think she sees herself as a victim. She responds. She's reactive.
Hmm.
She's being provoked and she's reactive. She has no need to. A tyranny implies that she has a need to be overbearing and to control people. I don't think she does. I think she's reactive. But that, anyway, we could talk about Machiavelli.
It's interesting. I'm thinking back to the episodes, but I don't have time. I'm going to go back to Machiavelli here.
All right. You want me to read it?
Do you want to read it?
Sure. Machiavelli believes to run a good state, you must take all necessary measures. You will get the most done if your people fear you rather than love you. Because if they love you, they will not be as motivated to protect their own safety. Therefore, a ruler who is a tyrant for good reasons is still a good person, because in the long run, the state and the people benefit, even if they don't think so. This is very Benito Mussolini. The ruler must be careful to not become hated, because then he will be overthrown. It's a delicate balance. Well, you know, this whole idea, it's better to be feared than loved. And I have to say, I don't agree with that.
Not at all.
Well, let's talk about as a parent. I don't know that it's better to be feared than loved. I think it's better to be respected than loved. And fear engenders something else. Fear means that you are being tyrannical towards somebody, that you're using your power to... I always feel like tyrants are deeply insecure, and they're using their power to make other people feel bad, to make themselves feel better.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like that.
Well, what about somebody you respect? Do you have any fear for someone you respect?
I think you fear... Yes, I think you fear... you fear losing their respect if you respect them.
Yeah.
You know, I think mm-hmm. they're that, but you're not fearing, what he's talking about is being a bully. Yeah. I fucking hate bullies more than anything. I hate bullies. Mm-hmm. See, Susie Green is not a bully. She's not bullying people to do what she wants to do. She's just defending herself and her family. There's a complete difference. Okay, she's a little over the top. She uh-huh. overreacts, but she's not a bully.
It's interesting, though, because she handles life so differently than you do. I mean,
correct. I don't have any bully in me. And it's one of my pet peeves. I hate bullies more than anything. I had my best friend since I was six was visiting me this weekend at my house upstate. And we were talking about a mutual, somebody else we grew up with, who was a bully and just, you know, just made everybody shiver when she was around because she was going to make you feel like shit and like this big. And everybody hated her. And she ruled and had friends because people were afraid mm-hmm. of her and afraid to not do what she said. And what kind of person is that?
Yeah. Well, I think you said it well before, insecurity.
Deeply insecure.
Yeah. Most people who are unpleasant are either insecure or they don't understand. You know, I think it's...
So just obnoxious.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know when you're planning on airing this because I'll just bring something timely up. There's this whole issue now with you know, Ray Rice and the NFL and Adrian Peterson. And first of all, anybody who puts a switch to their child's genitals is a bully. That is a fucking bully because that's a completely powerless person. And the whole idea about spousal abuse or girlfriend abuse, fiance abuse, whatever that is, that's about having power over somebody who is powerless. I don't care if she went at him first. He's a big fucking football player.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he clocked her. That is about abuse like that, and that's Machiavellian behavior because he's going to make, and the fact that she married him is another aspect of it. You know, she lives in fear of him and considers that love. You know, that's tyrannical behavior.
I think that's bad programming from childhood. I blame
correct
her parents.
Well, I mean, basically, that's what sociopaths do, is that they make you completely dependent upon them out of fear.
Mm-hmm. Because they don't know any other way to connect.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's either that, I think, or misunderstanding. People that just don't understand. I think that's a lot of... why you see wars going on in the world. A lot of it's just people
can't
don't...
Can't we all just get along, Danny?
I think it's just people don't understand each other and they don't take the time to try and figure it out. It's something seems so foreign to them and they...
Right.
Therefore, they're like, oh, this is no good.
Well, but that's... We demonize. That's what we've always done. That's what tribalism is all about. It's all about the other and keeping your own people safe and demonizing somebody else. We all demonize all the time.
I've talked to a few older comics on this show, and the common theme that's creeped me out a bit is that they all said this is the worst time in history. I'm glad I don't agree with that.
You know what? Only white men feel like this is the worst time in history. It's only the worst time for white boys. It's not the worst time for women, for blacks, for gays, for any other kind of minority. It's not the worst time.
I think they were talking in terms of fear for this country, in terms of fear for our lives.
You know what? My parents grew up during World War II, when the Nazis were murdering every Jew in sight. Mm-hmm. That was a pretty bad time.
Where did they grow up? Were they here?
Well, they grew up in New York, but I'm just saying, if they hadn't left Europe, their parents had, it wouldn't have been a good time.
Yeah.
I think that would have been a worse time. It depends on who you are and what you are. For me, as a female, this is not the worst time in history.
Yeah.
It's one of the best times in history, because I don't know when else in history I, as a woman, could make a living telling people to go fuck themselves.
Maybe ancient Egypt.
Maybe, but I doubt it.
Yeah, I think there was a few. Wasn't there a female pharaoh, I think, one or two?
Cleopatra.
Yeah, but before her, I think there was even...
Yeah, but that was just the upper echelon. I never would have been the upper echelon. I would have been a peasant.
You would have been a Jew.
I would have been a Jew, exactly.
Were you raised religious as a
kid? Not at all.
Not at all?
No.
Completely secular home?
Completely secular.
And have you... Do you have a belief in God?
No.
Did your parents?
No. That was one of the few things they did right, is they didn't indoctrinate me with religion. And I appreciate that, because if you choose religion later on in life, but when you're a kid and you're indoctrinated, that's it. You know, it's like deep inside your
That's how I grew up.
Deep inside of you, and talk about fear. Talk about indoctrinating your child into fear. You know, my husband is Catholic and was raised Catholic. He's not a practicing Catholic. And his parents were very religious. And I had this argument with my brother-in-law recently, because he's sending his kids, they're, 13, whatever, to religious instruction. Mm-hmm. And he says he doesn't believe in it. He doesn't believe in the religion anymore, but he's still sending his kids. And I said, well, why are you doing that, if it's something you don't believe in? And he said, because they need to, learn right from wrong, and they need to learn the basics. And I said, well, wouldn't you rather your kid know right from wrong just because it's intrinsically wrong, not because of fear of going to hell? It's like the idea of, you don't do something wrong because you're going to be punished, or do you not do something wrong because you know inside of you that it's wrong?
It's very interesting that he doesn't believe, and yet he's going to send them there.
Because he's indoctrinated.
Yeah.
He's indoctrinated. It's so deep when you grow up in a religious household. And I didn't, luckily.
That's so interesting. See, I grew up in a religious household.
Orthodox?
Orthodox, yeah.
Wow.
And I turned on it, and now I come back to it, Not completely, but I keep coming back to aspects of it that feel very familiar to me, or feel good to me, or enhancing to me.
I understand the comfort of religion because of the orthodoxy, and I say that at the big O, the orthodoxy of it, of any religion, which seems very limiting.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of rules. It's a lot to think about. It's a lot to think about in terms of you grow up in a community with very intelligent people, and they all believe this thing.
The problem I have is all of the three major religions seem so anti-female to me. I have a real hard time with all of them. And the Orthodox men say a prayer every morning thanking God for not making them a woman. Mm. That hurts me.
Yeah.
That bothers me. They wrap it around, but we respect women. But women are still not equal. And... just in the Bible. I mean, the Bible, within five pages, it talks about Eve took the fruit from the tree of knowledge, and she's punished for the rest of her life that she's going to have to listen to everything Adam says and have painful childbirth. That was a man who wrote that. No woman wrote that Bible. I am telling you that right now. That I really think that so much of what the Bible is about is controlling women. And if you read it from that point of view, go back and look at it from that point of view, and you'll see that that's exactly what it is.
I will. That's an interesting way of looking at it. Hmm.
Just like Machiavelli, if I may come full circle, was about controlling people. That's all it is. I mean, the Bible, religion, I think, was created to control people. And what's like, Catholicism? Well, how do you control people? Tell them their most base human instincts. are wrong, which is the impulse to procreate. If we didn't have that so powerfully in us, the species wouldn't exist. Mm. But tell people that's bad and wrong, and that's how you control them.
So you don't believe there's any God or anything or afterlife or any of that?
No. No.
But
maybe there is. I don't believe there's. Maybe there is, mm-hmm. but I think it's transcendent and unknowable. And I think anybody who tells you that they know, is ridiculous. It's unknowable. I don't know what's. I don't know what's afterlife. I don't have a belief in anything specific that's afterlife. I'll let you know.
Have you ever thought? What do you think is the purpose of this life?
You know, it's interesting because I have a housekeeper upstate who's evangelical, was brought up evangelical, and we get into these discussions all the time that she doesn't understand how I could be such an ethical, moral person if I'm not religious. To me, one thing has nothing to do with the other. I don't need, you know, a set of commandments to tell me mm-hmm. what's right or wrong or good or bad or kindness or evil or whatever. I believe in humanity. I believe in humanity. I believe in human kindness. I think it's one of the most underrated things out there. I believe in caring about one another. I believe in a collective unconscious. I believe that we're all connected in some kind of strange way. I don't know what it is, but there's something that connects us all. It's in our DNA. It's some kind of humanity. It's humanity.
Expand on that. What makes you feel that?
Because I feel it. It's just a feeling that I have in connecting to other people. It's just a feeling that I have in living in the world. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there's some sky god up there who's controlling everything. We're controlling everything. It's in our destiny. Mm-hmm. And we're the ones that have to make sure, you know, it's like praying to somebody else for peace and happiness. It's all within us.
Right.
And we have to do it within ourselves first, because the more better you take care of yourself, the more you have to give to other people. And then we have to be expansive, and we have to care about the world physically, the environment, people who, you know, like, for example, nationalism has always been something that kind of freaked me out. I love this country. I love it. But the idea that to hate somebody else because they by happenstance grew up somewhere else. Same thing with religion. You were born Jewish. Mm-hmm. You know, what if you were born into an Irish family and you were Catholic? It's you're Jewish because that's who you were born into. Mm-hmm. It's all happenstance.
Right. So patriotism, I've always felt that way too. It doesn't really make any sense. It's just you grew up in this. And it could get taken over and become another country.
It could. You know? I mean, I understand it, and I feel patriotic that I believe in the principles of this country. I believe in democracy, and I believe in freedom, and I believe that the things that this country stands for. And that's important to me, because if I was brought up in a Machiavellian dictatorship, mm-hmm. I wouldn't have the freedoms that I do. And as a comedian, you know, I mean, the first thing that goes in a dictatorship or a totalitarian regime is humor. First thing that goes, because humor is subversive by its nature.
Yeah.
So, I mean, as comedians, we're lucky to be living in a free society and in a democratic society. You know, book burning and all that, that's all anti-comedy.
Sure. That's why Lenny Bruce was so important, right?
And you know what's interesting about Lenny Bruce? Lenny Bruce, the reason why Lenny Bruce was arrested all those times, I believe, was not because of his use of language. It was because he took on religion. He took on the Catholic Church, and he took on religion. And that was the same thing with Bill Hicks. When he got, you know, taken off Letterman that time. It was Letterman, wasn't it? I believe so. He was talking about religion. That's the thing that nobody can talk about. You know, you could have a black president, a female president. You are not having an atheist president in this country, so that's why I'm not running.
Even nowadays, you think religion is a taboo?
Absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely. I think so.
I'm trying to think if there are any, you know, George Carlin went after religion a lot on HBO and stuff, but...
Religion is the thing that people... And I think that it gets people so on edge and their backs up so much is because it's doctrinaire. Because You have to 100% believe everything about it. And if there's any questioning, it's one of the reasons why I think that over the years, so many comedians have been Jewish. It's not that we're just naturally funnier. I think that there's something in the religion, in the study of the religion, that's very much constantly questioning like if you study the
very analytical,
Talmud, if you study the Talmud, you're constantly questioning. Whereas in other religions, you have to just take it on faith.
Yeah.
So I think that constant questioning is something that comedians naturally do. Is you see things a little twisted, and you're questioning, and you're not just taking anything. They're throwing shit at you, and you're not just saying yes, yes, yes. I take that and believe it on faith.
I've come to that same conclusion. I've thought about that and come to that as well. It's got to be Talmudic.
I think so.
It has to be, you know.
Which may be, you know, over thousands of years has somehow seeped into the DNA. Who knows? It's that. It's also being the outsider. You know, I mean, same with black comics, where there's so many great black comics. You're the outsider looking in. You know, there's always that piece. All comedians are misfits and feeling like we don't fit in, and the outsider looking in. It's a lot of things.
You think it's a coincidence that we've been persecuted so many times in so many places around the world?
Why have Jews been persecuted? You know, there's so many answers to that.
And why does it continue on?
I don't have an answer for that. I don't know. I just know that it's part of what I was talking about before, the demonization and the other, and it's scapegoating. It's like racism. It's no different, you know? Mm. Are we all racists? Are all white people racist in a certain way? Are all Gentiles anti-Semitic in a certain way? I don't know. But I know that we all, in our nature, have, because of tribalism, have a need to somehow make ourselves feel, I don't know if it's make ourselves feel better, but feel a part of something. We all have a need to feel a part of a community.
Yeah.
And part of being a part of that community is demonizing another.
Do you feel a sense of community as a Jew?
I would say I feel a sense of community more as a New Yorker than a Jew.
Do you still do any traditions? Do you do Passover and anything like that?
No.
None of it?
No. I mean, occasionally I'll go to a Seder if somebody invites me. But no, I don't.
Susie Green, I think, does Seder.
Susie Green does Seder, yes, yeah. Exactly.
Okay, let's go back to, would you mind reading
Machiavelli,
some more?
Machiavelli, okay. May 3rd, 1469 to June 21st, 1527. Was an Italian historian, politician, diplomat, philosopher, humanist, and writer based in Florence during the Renaissance. Or Renaissance, as some people say. He was for many years an official in the Florentine Republic with responsibilities in diplomatic and military affairs. He was a founder of modern political science, and more specifically political ethics. He also wrote comedies. Oh, that's carnival songs.
You think they're funny? You think
you know, the comedies back then were all like, it's like Shakespearean comedies. Mm-hmm. I hate Shakespearean comedies. You have the woman's dressed as a man and nobody notices, and it's stupid.
Doesn't hold up.
I know. His dramas do, though. His personal correspondence is renowned for the Italian language. He wrote his masterpiece, The Prince, after the Medici had recovered power and he no longer held a position of responsibility in Florence. So he was an outsider observing the Medici family, who were Machiavellian.
You can understand then why he might want to get power over everybody.
Machiavellianism is a widely used negative term to characterize unscrupulous politicians of the sort Machiavelli described in The Prince. So
it's not even him.
No.
It's from his work.
Right.
That's wild. People probably think he's the guy.
Machiavelli was born in a tumultuous era. Popes waged acquisitive wars against Italian city-states. This was a bad time. This was a bad time. And only the rich had any power. The poor were just like poor schleppers. Mm-hmm. People in cities often fell from power. It was constant. This is when the popes were really pieces of work. Along with the pope of the major cities, like this is whatever. I can't read all of this.
Yeah.
But it's all about militarism. However, Machiavelli's success did not last. In August 1512, he helped Pope Julius II use Spanish troops to defeat the Florentines at Prato. Machiavelli, blah, blah. He was buried in the church of St. Croce in Florence. An epitaph honoring him and is inscribed in his monument. The Latin legend reads, Tanto de blah, blah, blah. So great a name has no adequate praise.
I think
One thing I will say is, you know, in Poli Sci, we read The Prince. I mean, the guy's lasted. He's had some legs.
Yeah, I guess that's good. You know, he's immortalized in some way.
Well, it's political theory.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember from it?
I just remember that it was about power. It was about, you know, people who have power don't want to let go of power. That's just a fact. We were talking about white guys before. White guys have been in power for thousands and thousands of years. Now they're being threatened, and they don't want to give up their power. I don't blame them, but, you know, the writing's on the wall.
Yeah, well, people always talk about how amazing it is in our system that one president gives over power to another, even if it's from another party.
Right.
Which I always kind of was suspicious of, because I always kind of felt like it's a one-party system. You know?
Well, some people do think that, and they're all part of, you know, they're all Masons or something.
Well, not even like that. It's just sort of like what you're really getting. You know, when you have two choices, you have no choices, pretty much.
Right, right.
You know? We're not...
You know, except that there are times when there's very little difference between the two parties, but I think now there's more difference than ever because the polarization is just so intense.
Do you really believe that the president has control over the country, or do you think it's really just people funding him?
Oh, no. I don't think a president has control over the country. The president's a figurehead.
Or a party, even.
No, he's a figurehead. It's unwieldy.
It's nonsense, right?
It's unwieldy. It's not. I think he has power. I think he has, you know, one of the great powers that he has is he has power of the media.
Mm-hmm.
If he wants to have a press conference, if I say I want to have a press conference, nobody gives a shit. If I have something to say, he could be heard. So that in itself is power. Mm-hmm. He has legislative power. He has the executive power. He has power, mm-hmm. but it's not all powerful. He's not a dictator. We don't live in a totalitarian society.
Do you ever get caught up in this conspiracy stuff? Who really runs the country?
No.
And all that? None of that?
No.
You think it's pretty straightforward?
No, I think that it's probably accurate. There's probably like some cabal that runs the country. But I can't think about that. I got too much to do.
Yeah. That's why you need an assistant.
I don't need an assistant.
let's take a look at these quotes.
Okay. It is better to be feared than loved if you could not be both. I don't agree with that. I'd always rather be loved than feared.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe if you're a totalitarian dictator, maybe it's better to be feared, but I'm not a totalitarian dictator.
What about as a president? Do you think it's better to be, like for Barack Obama? Do you think it's, people say, oh, people aren't afraid of him enough. Putin's not afraid of him enough.
I don't know. I don't know. I'm not a political theorist. Mm-hmm. I think that if you're loved, if you're, well, what is love? I mean, it's better to be feared than loved. Well, what kind of love? Obsequious love, or is it true love, or is it, you know, is it, as I said, I think it's better to be respected.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're talking about fear, I think, you know, maybe you could say Putin doesn't fear him. Putin needs to respect him mm-hmm. more than fear. What is fear? That's just some...
Right. All right.
I don't know if that's a good answer or not.
I understood it.
Politics have no relation to morals. I don't know if I agree with that. I think that they frequently have no relation to morals, but they should have relation to morals because politics is about creating a world for people, and that world should have a relation to morality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is why we need to take care of those who are disenfranchised and less fortunate than us, and that's all part of politics. If you're talking about just politics as power, see, here's the thing. I'm a humanitarian. I believe that people have morality.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that people, more times than not, are good and care about one another and care about, but then again, then you see somebody like Dick Cheney and you just say, no. All right, I don't have an answer to that. Never was anything great achieved without danger. I agree with that somewhat, and that gets back to what we were talking about before about stand-up. And danger could be physical danger, it could be emotional danger, it could be... But I do think in order to do something great, to create a great work of art, there has to be some, there's got to be a gun to the head in some way. Mm-hmm. There's got to be some risk involved. And
is that fear?
It can be fear, but you, one of the things that you have to be, you have to be willing to fail, mm-hmm. in order to be really good at things, whatever it is. You have to be willing, as a comedian, you have to be willing to be bad in order to be good. And if you're not willing to be bad, you're playing it safe and you're not taking that risk. And so there is danger involved.
What breakthroughs mentally do you think you've had over the years as a comedian in terms of how you perceive what you're doing?
I think in the beginning, I was much more hostile to the audience because I was afraid of them. And I didn't have the technique at my fingertips to know how to manipulate, take control of what I was doing on stage. Mm-hmm. I think that this is going to sound strange, but I don't need them anymore. You know, I think that my whole day was, my whole sense of myself was predicated on whether or not they liked me, which I think goes back psychoanalytically is, when you, as an adult, when you let go, and it's not literal, it's internalized. When you let go of the internalized mother and father and needing their approval, your whole life changes.
When did you let go of that?
I would say somewhere in my 40s.
Wow, that long it took.
Yeah.
Damn it.
I would say somewhere in my 40s. And again, it's not literal. They could be dead. Mm-hmm. But it's the internalized mother and father and needing their approval. Sometimes it's both. Sometimes it's one or the other. And needing their approval. When you let go of needing their approval, then your performance becomes way freer. Your life becomes way freer because it allows you to just be who you are without that monkey on your back, on your shoulder, without that little voice in your head. What was that character called in the Flintstones?
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
But without
the little alien
without that little alien in your head watching what you're doing and judging what you're doing. And when you are able to let go of that, your whole life changes.
Do you remember, like, when you first realized?
Well, it's not a moment. It's cumulative.
Right, but do you remember when you first realized that, oh, I'm not thinking about that anymore?
No, I don't. Because all of a sudden, you go through days and you're just like, wait a minute, or weeks or months. And it's like, wait a minute, I feel differently. That thought hasn't occurred to me. Mm-hmm. And for a long time. It's not a light bulb moment.
Were your parents critical of you?
Yes, very.
Very?
Yes.
I'm happy to hear that because I always feel alone when I ask that question.
You're not alone. Trust me, Danny. Yes, very. And it's interesting because two different people told me recently that whenever they would come to my house, they would get a pit in their stomach because they knew that my father was going to say something to them that was going to make them feel stupid and humiliate them. And I found that so interesting. Oh, other people felt that too? I thought it was just me and my sister.
Wow.
You know, and brother. Other people felt that too. Mm. So he was a Machiavellian type of personality. He wanted to make other people feel bad to raise his status.
I wonder if in rebellion against that, you've decided I'm not going to be that way at all with these kids. You know?
Well, I will tell you this, and I really believe that I'm a very good mother. And my method of parenting was always to think what my mother would do and do the opposite.
It's directly a rebellion.
Yeah.
I can't laugh. It sucks. It's stupid asthma.
The asthma, by the way, is the internalized voice.
Yeah?
Yeah, definitely.
The internalized voice is wheezy?
Shut you up. Constrict your throat. Don't say anything. Yeah. Shut up. You can't breathe. You can't talk. That's the internalized voice.
So basically, I can shut the voice out with an inhaler. Just spray it away.
You know what? That's a good metaphor. That's a good visualization to think about. Just spraying them away in your head. Bye, your vapor.
So it is about a certain amount of independence that you took from your parents.
Yes, but I worked very hard to get there. It was not easy. It didn't come naturally. And it was tremendously painful. It was a tremendously painful struggle.
Like therapy or what?
A lot of therapy, psychoanalysis. But I knew that it was a life or death struggle. I knew that if I did not lose that and have my own voice, mm-hmm. as a comedian especially, but as a woman, that I was not going to survive. That's how it felt to me.
Wow. That's pretty... It's inspirational, and it's also intense. That's a heavy thought. Life or death.
That's how it felt to me. And I think, you know, to do stand-up, which is so hard, it almost had to feel like life or death. Otherwise, why do it? I could have just gone and be a dental hygienist.
How many years were you doing it before you hit a break?
I don't know, Danny. It was not... You mean a break in my career?
Where you weren't worrying about money constantly. That's assuming that you're not now.
That I'm still worrying about money. I always think I'm never going to work again. I don't know. A long time.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens is, you know, you start making a little more money, so you start spending a little more money. You raise your level, and, you know, so I still worry about money. I have not reached the point yet where I can't not work. I still have to work.
Mm-hmm.
And work hard.
You think you'll retire?
I'll never retire. You know, like I at some point maybe I'll stop doing stand-up and just do acting work or mm-hmm. whatever. I don't know.
You don't think you'll be like Joan Rivers in your old age?
No. Joan was very driven in a way that I'm not. I'm not driven like Joan.
Why do you think she was so driven?
I don't know. I don't know why. I didn't know her that well personally, but she was driven. And she loved what she did. Mm-hmm. She absolutely loved getting on stage and making people laugh. You know, it was joy for her. But she was definitely somebody who, well, you know, in her documentary, did you see her documentary?
Yeah, I did.
It's a fascinating piece of work. And in her documentary, you know, when she shows the date book and it's empty, and mm-hmm. she says something, I'm paraphrasing, you know what this means? This means that nobody wants me, nobody loves me, nobody needs me, I'm irrelevant. I don't feel that way when I see an empty week. I feel like, oh, I'm so happy I have an empty week. I get to lie on my sofa and catch up on my New Yorkers. My sense of myself is not tied to that. Clearly, and I don't know this, but I just know it from what I've seen, clearly her sense of herself was very wrapped up in her constantly being booked. So I don't know what drove Joan. She was driven. She was driven. She had an amazingly hectic schedule for somebody her age. But you know what? We're all better off for it, because I felt when she died, there's less laughter in the world. And I hate that.
Yeah. That's that collective energy you were talking about.
Yeah, I hate that there's no Joan. It's hard to believe there's no Joan. She was always there. Mm-hmm. And it's just sad.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're here.
I'm still here.
I hope you'll be here for a long time.
Me too.
And thanks for always being a good friend to me in this business. And thanks for doing this show.
My pleasure, Danny.
I appreciate it. I don't have a great sign-off. Do you have anything?
How about... Bye.
Sorry.
That's all right.
Stupid asthma.
Stupid fucking asthma.
Stupid fucking asthma.
Everybody, there it is. Thank you very much for tuning in. Thank you to Susie Essman for doing the interview. I don't think I got this Last Comic Standing thing. It's back up and running. I found out that Last Comic Standing, they figured out whatever was holding them back, and the show is back on, but I didn't hear anything that I got picked for it or anything. And you heard Susie and I talking about those clear spots in the calendar and how Joan Rivers used to freak out, and I used to kind of freak out too, but now I've had so many of them that I'd just be freaking out all the time if I worried about empty spots in my calendar. So I had this nice big chunk of empty space in my calendar, and I figured it's just about time I freak out and go to Israel and see if I can study some Judaism and Talmud and all that, and try and get to the bottom of all these questions that I have. So I found a program that's for a month. I subletted my place out here, jumping on a plane in a few days, and I'm heading over to Jerusalem. So that's what I'll be doing. Hopefully I'll do a broadcast or two from Jerusalem. I'll let you know what's going on with that. You gotta freak out sometimes, folks. So why not now? All right. Again, if you do feel up for it, you know, Mark Maron always says, kick me some shekels, but I'm literally going to be in Israel, so maybe kick me some shekels for real, man. I could use a donation or two. I'm doing this this Israel thing with, I don't know. I mean, I'll be real with you. I'm traveling to Israel with $200. So I don't know if that's stupid or not. I guess it is stupid, but you got to do these things sometimes, right? I don't know. A few years ago, I went to South Africa with $20 in my pocket. I got on okay. I did some stand-up shows. I got up on my feet within the first week, and I had a good time. So I'm no stranger to traveling the world as a peasant. But if you feel comfortable making a donation, go to moderndayphilosophers.net, click donate, make a donation. It would help me out on my trip, my spiritual journey out there, see what happens. And certainly would cost you nothing but a few seconds of your time is to jump on iTunes and leave a nice review and a 5-star rating in the iTunes store, and that helps the show quite a bit. So thank you guys. Thank you for a wonderful 2014. I've enjoyed getting to know a lot of you by email. You can email me, by the way, at thecomical@yahoo.com. That's thecomical@yahoo.com. And I've made quite a few email pen pals through this show, and I really appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to hearing from more of you in 2015. Please do whatever you can to spread the word about the show. Post it up on your Twitter, your Facebook. Tell people about it. One guy emailed me. He said he sent the show out to 40 friends of his on email. That's pretty awesome. I don't know if other people do that kind of thing, but if you can, that would certainly be very appreciated. And if not, don't worry about it. No pressure. Well, you know, I don't know either way what you're doing. The guy could have been lying for crying out loud. I doubt he was, but anyway, I thought it was a very sweet thing. A nice sentiment and very much appreciated on my end. So I get those listeners up. I can get more advertising. I'll be rich. I could be rich. I'll quit the show and then everybody loses. Huh? No, that's not how I plan for it to happen. That's not what I see going on. All right. I got to pack. I'm going to Jerusalem. Pretty wild, huh? All right. I'll tell you more about that when I'm there. And by the way, Kylie's there too. Kylie inspired. This is what happens when you have a girlfriend who converts to Judaism. She's like, I'm going off to Israel. I'm like, I'm not staying here alone. I'm going off to Israel too. So Kylie's already in Israel. I'm flying to Moscow, from Moscow to Jerusalem. And from Jerusalem, I'll be recording the intro and outro to the next episode. And I wish you guys a very Merry Christmas. And I'll speak to you very shortly. Goodbye.